I'm Ron Barr, and welcome to this special U.S. Airways in-flight presentation of Sports Byline USA. Sports Byline is America's sports talk show and heard on more than 200 U.S. radio stations, Sirius XM satellite radio, as well as worldwide on the Internet and the more than 500 stations of the American Forces Radio Network. On this special in-flight presentation of Sports Byline USA, we'll talk to Cincinnati Reds manager Dusty Baker about his career, his life, and the way he views himself and the game he's played and now manages. As in most sports, there's only a handful of icons of those sports, and in baseball, one of the most enduring icons is Hank Aaron. Many feel he's still baseball's career home run record holder. His life and career is the subject of Howard Bryant's insightful book, The Last Hero, A Life of Henry Aaron. We'll talk with Bryant about his book. And with another NFL season here, we'll spend time with Jerry Robinson, a College Football Hall of Famer. Robinson played linebacker for 13 years with the Philadelphia Eagles and Oakland Raiders. He'll share the high and low moments of his playing career with us. So sit back and enjoy this special in-flight presentation of Sports Byline USA. First up, Dusty Baker. He played 16 seasons and won a World Series championship with the LA Dodgers. After a successful playing career, Baker got his first chance to manage with San Francisco. In his first year, he was named the National League's Manager of the Year, winning 103 games. He won that award three times. And after managing the Giants for 10 seasons, he also managed the Cubs for four and now is a Cincinnati Reds manager. Baker is a former Marine, and his view of his life and baseball is no nonsense. So I asked him about the correlation between Dusty Baker the man and Dusty Baker the player and manager.
Well, you know, you'd like to think they're the same, but basically a lot of times people are different between your job and you personally. I mean, I try to stay as consistent as possible. As far as what you see is what you get. You know, try to remain as basic as possible in a lot of areas, but realize that, you know, that everybody, including myself and the world, is at a very complicated, you know, state of mind. So, I don't know, the correlation is, I guess, you know, both like to win on the field and off the field and like to win as often as possible, like every time if possible, but, you know, not at all costs, which, you know, to me is sort of a dilemma every once in a while.
Understanding the business of sports, the business of baseball, has it always been easy? Has it been difficult to always be Dusty Baker the person?
No, not at all. I mean, basically, I mean, it's hard, you know, to – be independent and remain yourself, but be, you know, the baseball man and how the company perceives you or wants you to be at the same time. It's very difficult. You know, you just try to do what's right. You try to do what's morally right. You try to do what, you know, what you think is right in your own mind, you know, how you're raised, you know, right in the eyes of God too at the same time, but realize it's a business. And, a lot of times trying to do what's right and doing what's right in the eyes of God and the eyes of man, there's always a conflict there because, you know, whenever there's a dispute or a dilemma, the average person I talk to in business seems to say it's okay if it's only business. And whether it's a lie or whether it's the truth or whatever it is, but, you know, I just try to live by, you know, how I was taught and raised by my parents, basically.
Is that challenge greater because you happen to be a minority? And what I mean by that is that if somebody did something and they were not a minority, it may be just kind of looked over, whereas somebody would say, well, that's, you know, come up with a thought about the person because of that. Staying true to yourself, has that been a little bit more of a challenge?
Well, I mean, it's a challenge, but it's something I'm used to. I've been a minority all my life. So the thing about it is that, I mean, you realize that, you know, the fields of play are different. You know, the expectations are different. And I know this is instilled in me when I was a kid. My mother told me that, you know, to get equal, you know, to get the same thing as a non-minority, you have to be twice as good, you know, which is how my mom taught us and then how we were raised. A lot of times you have to know when to choose your battles. You know, a lot of times you have to you know when to hold them and when to fold them, like, you know, so to speak. So, but at the same time, how it was explained to me when I was a kid is that, you know, there's an outer dignity and the inner dignity. Sometimes your outer dignity has to take some things in order, you know, to maintain and keep the job that you're in. But no man has the right to intrude upon your inner dignity, and then the job or anything else isn't important if someone, you know, treads upon that territory.
Usually a person is a collection of the influences in their lives, and most notably from their parents. So let me ask you this question. Your mom and your dad, what were the things that contributed to making you who you are today?
I would like to think I'm, which we are, a combination of both. I mean, my mom's highly educated. My mom's highly motivated towards education. Very proud. My dad is also very proud and a man of a relative education, but probably has a doctorate degree in common sense. So I like to think I was a combination of both of them. We were raised in a way of try to be as truthful and honest as possible. And if you can't be, then don't say anything. And, my parents were major influences on us. A lot of the influences you didn't like as a kid, most of them you didn't like. You know, like go to church, go to school, keep your room clean, don't lie, don't gamble, all these kind of things that, you know, that you were taught but weren't very – I mean, the exciting way is the bad way. The exciting way is the street way. And so I'd like to think that I have quite a bit of knowledge streetwise and relative knowledge, educationally. And I like to think I was a combination of both.
What was Riverside, California like?
Riverside was a great town. It was a town of about 50,000 people at that time. A lot of orange groves, a lot of agriculture. A lot of people lived off the land. Had a lot of people, come from elsewhere. Basically, my mom was born in Indio, California. My dad's from Florida. Met my mom there after the war and settled there. And it was a town of two major high schools, two other high schools. One, Indian Sherman Institute, which was Navajo school for Indians, and we had a deaf school at the time. And everybody played together. Everybody went to school together at some point in time. The town was such where there were only a couple little leagues, one pony league. One Colt League, and so the best of the best played. I mean, we had a highly competitive ball. Everybody played together. Like I said, I don't know, my dad probably had 7 to 10 guys make it to the major leagues from his little league team. Bobby Bonds was the marquee player. We had another probably 15 or 20 guys from Riverside, Mike Corkins and Tommy Hall and Bill Parsons and like I said, myself and Bobby Bonds, we had quite a few guys, Stan Davis, a lot of guys that, sports was a focal point of our town. And, most of the minorities lived on one side of town. And then, most of the, more affluent people lived across the Victoria Bridge. I lived right at the start of the bridge. And so, it was a town. I mean, it was a nice time. I'm glad that I was born in Riverside. Also, at the same time, I was glad that, we moved from Riverside when I was 15, because I don't think I might have been, noticed being in a suburb of L.A. And being a suburb of L.A., to be recognized and noticed, you had to be a mega player, like a Bobby Bonds, in order to be recognized.
Was there anything in your early life that was influential, either an event or a series of events that influenced you early in your life?
Bobby Bonds was a major influence over me. He played all sports. He played four sports. I played four sports later because trying to be like Bobby Bonds. Probably a major influence on my life, probably at that time, was to be named an alternate in 4 years in a row. And, when you have a talent that size, most of the time the sponsors' kids are the kids that make the All-Star team.
Mm-hmm.
And I was like, I couldn't understand why this guy was ahead of me on the All-Star team. But my dad explained to me that the guy's father was on the back of the uniform. And so that pushed me harder, to be better and to succeed. I mean, if there's any one thing that probably stood out as much as anything, it was that one. Especially when I was 15 and 16, I think our team went to the Colt League World Series. We went to Shawnee, Oklahoma, and I was an alternate. And the only way I could have been on the team was somebody got hurt. But at that time, you're like torn between wishing somebody got hurt, which is bad. And my dad told me that. He says, you don't wish bad on anybody because it happened to you, but also wanting to go at the same time.
Yeah. Was baseball a big influence in your life when you were young then? Or sports in general?
Well, just sports in general. I mean, my house was a house. I mean, my dad's a pretty smart guy. I mean, we had the big backyard that he planted grass in, and that was a football field. and he put up lights over the garage, and that was basketball court. And there's the baseball field in the backyard. So everybody sort of, you know, most of the guys, at least my age, came over to my house to play. So my dad knew where I was almost all the time. And then about 4 o'clock in the afternoon, my dad came home from work. They'd all disappear until my dad went to his second job at 4:30, because if they were there at 4 o'clock when he got home, he put them to work. You know, like in the middle of summer, cleaning leaves out the gutters. It hadn't rained in about 4 months. But my dad goes, hey, all you guys rake leaves and do this and that. So at 4 o'clock, I was begging guys to stick around. So I didn't have to do that work by myself. But like I said, my dad and mom were, I mean, I'm very, very glad they raised me the way they did.
Talk to me about the decisions, not only that Dusty Baker has to make as a manager, but any manager has to make. I mean, whether to throw to one more batter, guy gets a base hit, whether to take the pitcher out, whether to make the double switch, all of those things. I mean, are those things that keep managers, keep you up late at night thinking, golly, I wish I'd done something wrong?
Well, I mean, they keep you up, you know, but you can't necessarily dwell on them. I mean, you got to stick with your decision. I mean, that's the thing I learned in this job. When you make a decision, you got to stick with it. And you got to calculate it. You got to use your guts. You got to use your feelings. You got to use numbers sometime. You got to use, you know, how much a guy has thrown. And there is no set formula. And the one thing about it is, you know, conviction is the key. You know, once you are saying, hey, this is what I'm going to do, I mean, it's easier on your team to accept it because they hate to see a guy that's sort of wishy-washy. And, I mean, let's face it, as a manager or a coach, you're at the mercy of how the players perform. I mean, if they perform, you look good. And if they don't come through, it's your fault. And, you know, that's the difference between sports now, I think, than when I was playing. Or, you know, when I was playing, you know, I mean, if I didn't come through, I would feel badly. You know, it wasn't Lasorda's fault. It wasn't this guy's fault. I mean, it's a sign that time has changed. I mean, at the time, you know, I look back when I see Ralph Branca and the shot heard around the world, Bobby Thompson. I mean, you never hear that Ralph Branca was brought in really for people that aren't historians. You know, I mean, who blames the manager for bringing Branca in and taking Newcomb out? You know, I think that's how the story goes.
Right.
But, I mean, it's a different time, it's a different day, because winning is, you know, is everything now.
Dusty Baker has joined us here on Sports Byline USA. Dusty, when did baseball become a serious intent for you?
Probably after my parents got divorced when I was, in the process of divorce my senior year in high school. And quite frankly, I wanted to be a football or basketball player. And baseball was the hardest sport for me to play at the time and excel in. Because, I wasn't the biggest kid in the school. I was skinny. I could run. I could catch. I could throw. I could hit. I just couldn't hit with power because I didn't have any power. But baseball became a major influence, I guess, when I got drafted out of high school. And I prayed the night before the draft, you know, because my dad wanted me to go to the University of Santa Clara, which I didn't really want to go to another predominantly white school like I had gone to in high school. And it was, you know, pretty affluent school. And I had a bicycle. A lot of guys had GTOs and Mustangs and Cobras and stuff over there. And at that time, like I said, I got drafted out of high school, and I didn't want to really I prayed not to get drafted by the Braves because I didn't want to go to the South. And then the next morning, I got drafted by the Braves. And I said, Lord, you didn't hear me. And so, but as things always have turned out, that was the best thing for me because Hank Aaron promised my mom that he would take care of me as if I was his son away from home, and which he did. And I met Lenny Cepeda and Cleve Boyer, and, you know, I ended up playing with Joe Pepitone and Denny McClain and some of the good boys and bad boys at that time. And these guys helped, you know, teach me, you know, a lot at a very young age.
I remember Joe Morgan, of course, another Californian who played and started his career in Raleigh-Durham. And he told me one time, he said the first time he took the field, he said all the black people were in one part of the stadium. And he said he called his dad and says, I'm just not going to deal with this.
The first time for me, I went to Little Rock, Arkansas. And our home base was in Austin, Texas. And Ralph Gar and I signed. He signed out of college, Grambling College. I signed out of high school. My first game was in Little Rock, Arkansas. Cito Gaston was in center field. And I was in right, and Ralph was in left. And that day, they have a mental institution right next to the ballpark. And so that was my first game on a Thursday. And I think every Thursday they let a lot of the people out of the mental institution to come down and see the game. So the first ball hit to me, I dropped it, and I heard some names that I had never heard before, but I didn't know these people are from the Mill Institute. And they're calling me some names. I'm like, oh, my God, what have I gotten into? So I want to come home, too. I called my mom. I said, hey, Mom, I want to come home. She goes, too late now, son. So I remember I started crying, and Cito told me that, you know, hang with me, kid. I'll take care of you. As a matter of fact, you know, he's still helping me and taking care of me. And, you know, I call him quite often whenever I – you know, I'm in a dilemma or a situation, or just to say hello, because I know he'll tell me the right answer.
And you know, coming from a multicultural environment like California was, and I know that there's racism everywhere, but certainly not as out there as it is in the mm-hmm. South. I mean, how hard was that for you as compared to somebody that may have grown up in the South and was accustomed to it all their life?
Well, it was hard, but at the same time, it was very enlightening in a lot of ways. Because, you know, when I went to the South, I mean, you think that everybody that has a Southern accent and that's white's in the Klan. And I met some very good people in the South. I mean, some very good people in the South. They still got long accents, as a matter of fact. But, you know, I met some good people and I met some tough people. I had some tough times down there. But at the same time, you know, it taught me, at that time, and this was the late 60s, you know, there's a lot of racial unrest in our country, and, you know, a lot of turmoil was going on. There were riots, there were freedom marches, there were all kinds of things that were happening late to mid-60s.
And the integration of schools in Arkansas,
too. Oh, yeah, and Arkansas and Georgia and, right. You know, where I was. And I played all through North Carolina, South Carolina, West Virginia, Texas, you know, Louisiana. And really, when I came back to California, I had a better idea about life. I think that was one of the better things that happened to me, because when I got back here and then I saw things that I was naive to before I left. And so that was probably one of the best things that happened to me, you know, was going to the South and then coming back, you know, to the West Coast, because I came back with a different outlook, a different idea, and noticed and saw things that I might not have seen before.
You mentioned about Hank Aaron kind of taking you underneath his wing. I suppose that he probably was like that to a lot of black athletes. Do I assume correctly?
Yeah. I mean, especially took care of Ralph Garman, myself in particular, because we were two young rising prospects, you know, trying to be stars. And, I mean, Hank not only was good to us, he was good to everybody. I mean, not only black athletes, Hank was good to Mike McQueen and some of the Latin guys that came up, too, with us at that time. And so, you know, Hank helped us in a lot of ways. I mean, Hank, you know, was a very proud man. He was one of the executives in NAACP. You know, we were there with Andrew Young. Here I was, a little kid, but Andrew Young and Maynard Jackson and, you know, Jesse Jackson, a lot of the, you know, civic leaders of our time back in that time. And, you know, Hank would take us with us everywhere. I mean, with him everywhere. And that was one of the best experiences, like I said, that I've ever had.
Did it make you humanly and also maybe politically conscious being in that environment back in Atlanta because of what you said, Martin Luther King and all the other people that were in the forefront, really, of the black movement at that time?
Well, yeah, I mean, it made me very conscious, but also when I moved to Northern California, we got Berkeley up there. I mean, that kind of you were conscious before you left. You know, it's just that it was a different consciousness. You know, it was probably, you know, with the Panthers here in Oakland and Berkeley, and my parents being NAACP leaders, you know, in our community of Riverside, especially before we moved to Northern Cal. You know, it was more of a combination of a revolutionary type
environment
in the North, and it was more of a nonviolent sort of peace environment in the South, because revolutionaries just didn't
show their heads.
Yeah, exactly. I mean, if he did, it wasn't on there too long.
Yeah.
You know what I mean? So it just sort of taught me, you know, rounded me off, you know, big time at a young age. And I went through different periods of my life. I went through different periods of my life when I was, you know, going through a period of life when I was militant. I was going through periods of life when I was, you know, peace and love up North. And I went through a life when I was going to join the Muslims before my dad, you know, prohibited that at the time. And so, like I said, and then right from there, I went to the Marines, you know, during that same period of time. So there's a bit of confusion in my life.
I was going to say, there's a lot of contradiction here.
Well, there's a lot of contradiction, you know, because then, you know, the Afros are big.
Right.
You know, because you show your, you know, political feelings by how you dress, especially then, and how you wore your hair. Well, you know, like if you're in the Marine Reserves and you're going once a month, you know, how much can your afro grow in a month before you got to get another haircut? So I'm like, hey, guys, I feel kind of like you do, but even though I'm over here. But that was, you know, necessary at that time because Vietnam was hot and the Braves got tired of me missing an entire year in school and coming out in June. And they said I had a choice, you know, between the National Guard and the Marines. So I chose the National Guards at that time. The Marines at that time. And, again, that was something else that helped me, to round me about people and how to get along with people. Because at that time our society was cleaning out the jails. Say either go to Marines or go to jail. And so half our guys that are in our platoon at that time, I don't know if it's quite that high, but it's pretty close, were guys that it's sort of like the Dirty Dozen.
Mm-hmm.
And so that taught me that, I mean, there were guys from Altoona. I remember PA that couldn't, you know, that said his ABCs on Christmas Eve in front of the platoon. And there were guys from New York. We had some Puerto Rican guys from New York. We had some guys from Cleveland, some guys from everywhere. And so...
A real melting pot.
Oh, yeah. We had a couple lawyers in there. Big Bob Spence was in there with me. Went to Santa Clara. The same guy that showed me around on my visitation time ago to Santa Clara, he was in the same, time I was in. So it was a real melting pot, and that taught me, hey, man, there are good people everywhere, regardless of education, regardless of if you were getting out of jail, or regardless of, you know, if you were a lawyer or whatever. So that just helped me to try not to be as judgmental as I was before.
But when you look at all those influences and everything, what was the thing you learned the most about Dusty Baker that has helped you the most during the course of your life?
Probably try not to judge people too much, you know, especially in the very, very beginning. And try not to use...
Look at the big picture, in other words.
Yeah, you know, and try not to say this guy's from here, this guy's from there, so he got to be this or that. And try to make snap judgments about people, because some of the people I dislike the most end up being the people I like them, you know, the most later. Uh-huh. Or some guy that I thought was great end up being terrible later. So I just try to go into every situation with your eyes
open. Can that apply to sports?
Oh, definitely. I mean, it can definitely apply to sports.
Dusty, you mentioned about the fact that you did not want to be drafted by Atlanta. And I'm going to ask you that from a baseball standpoint, the fact that Atlanta was known as the launching pad, did it work to your advantage from a baseball standpoint? Did it help as far as establishing what you could do in the sport of baseball?
Well, at that time, I thought it hurt me, actually. You know, because I came in as a spray hitter, hit the ball over the ballpark. I was a leadoff hitter in the minor leagues. With speed was my game. And then I started growing. I got bigger and stronger. And I had 17 home runs my first year, and I had never hit over, like, 11 in my life. And then I hit, like, 20, and I hit 21. And I've always said, if you go to a small ballpark as a young player, especially when you have new strength that's coming to you, that's a detriment, because you start feeling your strength and you start trying to hit home runs. Then my batting average, I went from third in the league my first year in the big leagues to – but in my fourth year, hitting like 256, 261. I mean, I was hurt part of the time, but I know part of it was because I was trying to hit home runs. I would suggest a smaller ballpark. The smaller ballparks like Boston and some of the ballparks with the Green Monster accessible fences for guys that have been strong their whole life, and you know, because they remain hitters instead of trying to turn into sluggers, or for a veteran ball player that knows what he can do and doesn't let the small dimensions affect him. Now, as a young ball player, those small dimensions, after a while, hurt me, because there's something that that happens. I call it home runitis. It's a dangerous disease. I mean, it's terminal sometimes.
At that fence and you say, I got to have it.
And you just keep swinging for it, and next thing you know, you're hitting 230. And that's home runitis. And so that's what happened to me. I developed home runitis after a while, and I'm glad I went to L.A., where the ball didn't travel as well. Then I went back from trying to slug to just being a hitter with power.
Did you become a ball player, and when I mean a ball player, somebody that mm-hmm. could field, that could hit, that understood the game, really became that mature baseball player while you were in Atlanta during those 8 years? And do you remember exactly when that might have happened?
I don't know. I mean, guys used to say I played older than I was, actually.
Right.
You know, because
I've heard that about you.
You know, because I didn't make – I prided myself on not making mistakes, whether it's on the bases or whatever. I probably matured once I got to L.A., I think, and got in a more winning atmosphere, because it was really bugging me and driving me crazy, the losing, even though we were doing pretty good offensively. we were losing. And I just don't like losing. You know, I mean, no matter what I'm doing, or I mean, it gets tough to excel on a losing team. And then after a while, it got to me, and then you end up with a bad attitude. Next thing you know, it was time to go. But I requested the trade. I asked Eddie Robson, I wanted to go back home. And he kept asking me, had I ever been to Cleveland? I said, why does this guy keep asking? I went to Hank Aaron. I said, Hank, why does this guy keep asking me if I ever been to Cleveland? And at the time, Cleveland didn't have this pretty ballpark that they have right now. They played in the old Cleveland Brown Stadium, I guess that's the name of it, with like 80,000 seats. There'd be 50,000 people, and there'd still be 30,000 empty seats.
Lakefront Stadium.
Yes, it was, too. And so I saw that when I played in the All-Star game in 81. So Hank says, Dusty, you know, that's where they send guys when they want to send them to the Siberian front. That's where the Dodgers sent Sutcliffe when he tore up Lasorda's office. That's where Lynn Barker got sent from Atlanta. Whoever was kind of a bad attitude or bad actor, they'd send him to Cleveland. And so fortunately for me, Eddie Robinson sent me back to L.A., and that was one of the greatest moves of my life at that time.
I think you know as well as I do, back when you were playing, I think players really took on the personality of the organization. You learned to do it the Dodger way. You learned to do it the Yankee way. When you got into the Dodger organization, what was that Dodger way?
Well, right, the first day I got there, they sent me they gave me a book, The Dodger Way to Play Baseball. And naturally, I didn't read it. and that night, I missed the cutoff, man, two nights later. And Davey Lopes came up to me and said, hey, we don't play like that over here. And I said, hey, man, I don't want to hear it. Get out of my face. And next thing I know, here's Bill Russell, here's Joe Ferguson, here's Steve Yeager, here's Ron Say, Steve Garvey. After a while, I'm outnumbered like 15-1. And so I'm like, hey, that's cool, man. You guys got me outnumbered. And I went home that night and read the book. I had never told him I read the book. But that night I read the book. And there is a certain, you know, way to play play different games. I mean, like you said, you take on the personality of the organization, but also the guys take on the personality of whoever the superstar is at that time, too. If the superstar is flamboyant, the young kids are going to think that's how you be a star. Or if a superstar is humble like Hank Aaron, that's how Hank, you know, he wouldn't let us be demonstrative or too boisterous at the time, and you take on that, too. But, yeah, there is a way to play Dodger baseball at that time. You know, we never beat ourselves. We played good defense. We ran the bases well. We played good fundamental baseball, speed, pitching, and defense. And then if somebody popped one, then, it was almost game time. And so I've tried to incorporate some of the Dodger way that I was taught to play, as well as the offensive game that I learned from the Braves, because we could hit. I mean, we had some guys over there that could really hit. And so, all these things have, has helped me in my playing days and also in my managerial career as well.
You alluded to it a little bit earlier when you said about living in Riverside and how kind of flashy and Hollywoodish it was in that area, the Los Angeles areas. Now you go from Atlanta, which is kind of down home in the deep south, and you go back to Hollywood in a sense. Was that the way the Dodgers were? Were they Hollywoodish in a sense?
No, we weren't as much as the town was or people expected us to be. I mean, we did think we were pretty cool. at that time, everybody had tight uniforms on. The Dodgers always had the whitest of white uniforms. And sometimes you get caught up in it. I mean, we all get caught up in it at some point in time. But after a while, I was ready to come back up north. I was ready to come back home, Northern California, because this is more conducive to my lifestyle, my attitude about things, period. And, that was one of the real focal points of my divorce. Was the fact that I wanted to come back up north, and my former wife wanted to like L.A. and wanted to stay in L.A. So, I'm just glad I came back home.
8 times you went to the playoffs. 3 times you went to the World Series. You were the MVP of one of the series, playoff series as well. You win the championship in 81. Can you talk to me about that 81 championship season, and how was that different, say, from the other 2 times that you guys went to the World Series?
Well, actually, that was our worst team, I thought. I thought our best team was 77, and at that time, and our second best team I thought was 78. And our 81 team, Reggie Smith was hurt, Davey Lopes was gone. Let me see, who else was gone? That's about the time they start dismantling our giant team. And that was a team that really fought back through a lot of adversity, because that was the first year they had the 3-tiered playoffs. and they had the first series the best out of five. Well, we were down 2-1. And then the next series was best out of five. We were down 2-1 again to Montreal. I think we were down 2-1 to Houston the first time, down 2-1 to Montreal the second time. And we were down 2-0, I think, to the Yankees that time. So that was the year of the comeback. I mean, people like, say, in Chicago, people say you're up 3-1. Well, I've been up 3-1 and won. I've been down 3-1 and won. I've been down, 2-1 and won. So, that was a year that, was just supposed to be to me. In 77, 78, we were almost ashamed and embarrassed for about a couple of weeks. We didn't even leave our house. The guys didn't leave our house because we felt so badly about losing, because at that time, especially, L.A. was a town that you had to win it all or else you were, you were a loser. The Lakers were tough then, Magic and Kareem and those guys. USC was tough. USC was tough in football. UCLA was number one in basketball. I mean, the Angels are good. The Rams are good. I mean, everybody in town was good at that time, and everybody sort of fed off each other. But those are great, great times that I look back that, everybody was winning.
Dusty Baker is as straightforward in baseball as he is in life. Baseball is called America's pastime because of our strong connection to the game and the men who play it. We all have our favorite players, managers, and teams, but there are only a handful of baseball icons, those who have left their impression on fans no matter who they played for. Willie Mays, Mickey Mantle, Nolan Ryan, just to name a few. But the top of that list of baseball icons is Hammerin' Hank Aaron. Over his 23-year playing career, Aaron established himself as one of the game's greatest hitters, and he still holds Major League Baseball's records for career runs batted in and career extra base hits. And he was baseball's all-time home run hitter with 755 until Barry Bonds eclipsed that mark with his controversial and alleged drug-tainted career. Aaron's life, his path in baseball, and his career had many twists and turns. Author Howard Bryan has written the first definitive biography called The Last Hero, A Life of Henry Aaron. I asked Bryan what it was that interested him in the subject of Henry Aaron.
I think the first thing that really got me about him was where I was as a journalist 5 years ago. And in finishing Juicing the Game, I really was looking for a project that kind of ran counter, that served as an antidote to a lot of the cynicism of the steroid era. And I began to think more and more that the center of this story, when people talk about that distance between watching the game and believing in it, the name Henry Aaron kept coming up in every conversation, whether it was with ballplayers or with fans. And I began to think more and more about maybe there was a bigger project here than to simply do an interview with him and ask him how he felt about the world. And I remember speaking with him, and I looked on my bookshelf, and I told him that I see big books from a lot of guys in the Pantheon. I see Williams. I see Ruth. I see DiMaggio. I don't see you. And I didn't see Mays either, but I was much more taken. And who knew that a Mays book was being done as soon as I was doing the Aaron book? But I was really taken by Henry Aaron because of what he meant to me and how much he served as a timeline from start to finish.
You know as well as I do that there are only a handful of baseball players who really can be called icons of the game. I think of Mickey Mantle. I think of Willie Mays. I think of some of the other names you just mentioned. Why are those names, including Hank Aaron, Henry Aaron, icons of the game?
Well, I think they're icons, one, simply because of their talent. I mean, to be that good, to be as good as they've been, and to last as long as they've lasted. But I think there's an intangible there as well, and that intangible is there are certain people, and the only people that I think really come close, believe it or not, are broadcasters, where these people serve as a bit of a soundtrack for your life. And when people think about the moments when they were happiest as children or happiest as a young adult or as fans, the same people seem to keep coming back, Mays, Aaron, DiMaggio, and they serve as that timeline that I'm talking about. And when I started to think about the merits of this project, I began thinking about this country and about what the American dream meant to me. And when I thought about it, I thought about Henry Aaron, who was born in the Depression in the Deep South, and to live in a country today where
everything is possible. And when he was born, for his people, nothing really was possible except a life of hard labor and disrespect. So to be that person, to see it through on the other side, I thought was pretty fascinating.
I thought it was interesting when you quoted sportscaster Bob Costas, and I thought it summed it up correctly. When he was talking about Willie Mays, he said that we associate him with fun and remember him with fondness, but with Aaron, it's all about respect. And in the final analysis, it was that respect, was it not?
Absolutely. And it's that respect that drew me to him, even though you could make the very easy argument, and people have made it, that he was nowhere near the charismatic figure of a Clemente or a Robinson or certainly of a Mays. But in the book, I make numerous analogies, and the one that I made to him that I like the best was he's the reliable wood stove. There were all kinds of other fireplaces that gave off less heat, but he's the wood stove. He kept the room hot, and he was there throughout the time. And I think that the additional part of it that really kind of drew me to him was that that's what we need today. When I thought about doing this project, I kept thinking about this theme, whether we're talking about Enron or the housing crisis or the mortgage crisis or steroids, that there's this loss of integrity and accountability, and you seem to be almost a Pollyanna if you lament the days for accountability. That, gee, there was a time when you actually had to at least give the appearance that you were telling the truth, and today it's really not like that, that these values of integrity seem almost quaint, and I wanted to at least go back and rediscover somebody who I felt exemplified those values.
In reading an article about your book, the author of that article said, Aaron is clearly a hard man to get to know. Now, I've interviewed him before, and I thought when I read that quote that he probably did that as a defensive mechanism. I know it was a product of his upbringing, but why is he a hard man to know, and is it a defensive mechanism for him?
I think the answer is yes, and I think it's both. And I think that In that review, I read it myself, and I said, absolutely 100% right, and he continued on to say, and I'm not sure Howard Bryant actually knows him, and he's right, because in the 4 years working on this project, you realize that Henry Aaron is a man of very, very tough defensive coverings, and I understand why. When you grow up where he grew up.
Let's talk about where he grew up for just a moment. Mobile, Alabama. Take us back to Mobile, Alabama, where he was born and raised.
Well, when you go to Mobile in 1934, when he was born, believe it or not, it was considered one of the more tolerant places in the Deep South, which is why so many blacks moved there, because there was work and the segregation, while solid, was not as reprehensible or not as oppressive as it was in, say, Birmingham. And people thought that this place, especially African Americans, felt like this was a place where you're not going to have complete freedom, but you're going to at least be able to make a living. And yet, in comparison to the North or comparison to California or other places, this was a horrible, horrible place. And for Henry Aaron to begin to see, as his baseball career continued, to see that the rest of the world wasn't like this, it did harden him. And certainly, I think it hardened him more watching what happened to the previous generations of Aaron men. And I think there was a part of him that felt very fortunate that his talent allowed him to have a different life. But at the same time, it certainly did not assuage the fact that his dad and his grandparents and his brothers were never going to be allowed to be what they wanted to be simply because of the social conditions.
And I really felt, as it was written in that article, that he was very embarrassed to see his dad humiliated because of his race, that he would see his father forced to surrender his place in line at a general store to any whites who entered. And when you're a young child of any age that you have an understanding, probably not a complete understanding, that probably, in a sense, fostered a very, distinct impression upon him.
No question. No question. And I can honestly say that when you think about your own family, I mean, obviously, I think he would have rather had that stuff happen to him instead of having it happen to people that he cared about. And I think that as his baseball talent blossomed, and as he began to realize the scope of his ability, he never forgot that the goal was to change social conditions, was to do his part to make sure that there were going to be generations behind him who didn't have to go through what he had to go through and what the generations before him had to go through. And that's pretty big for a baseball player. And I think that's one of the things we've gotten wrong about Henry Aaron. There's this conversation about him being so bitter. And the other part of it is that we've always compared him to somebody else. We compare him to Mays when he first came up. You compare him to Ruth when the record came time to be broken. And then when his record was broken, we compare him to Bonds. And the real person that Henry Aaron actually wanted to be compared to was Jackie Robinson. Jackie Robinson is his idol because before Jackie, you could not dream. And after, you could. And that is the person where Henry Aaron said, this is what I want to be. And I think you can see that in his post-career, that he's always tried to be somebody who opened up doors to continue the Robinson mission, whether it be in the managerial office, which he never became but fought hard for, and also the front office of the Braves.
Yeah,
and now with his foundation as well.
Henry was 13 years old when Jackie Robinson broke the baseball color line in 1947, but what was it that brought him to baseball rather than some other direction?
Talent, more than anything else. I think he understood very quickly that he had ability, and he understood that not only did he have ability, but it was the only thing that he actually felt really comfortable doing. I remember in Cooperstown last year when I was working on the manuscript asking him, what was your backup plan? I said, I make an argument in the book that you did something even more remarkable than Jackie Robinson. Jackie Robinson had a college education. Jackie Robinson was a veteran. He was schooled and articulate, and you had nothing. You dropped out of school, and you bet everything on baseball. And Jackie probably would not have approved of this, because the message when you met him was to stay in school, and you ignored that. And he said, yes, it wasn't 1, 2, 3 with me. It was this or nothing. It had to work. I had to be a baseball player.
Howard Bryan is with us on Sports Byline. And again, I want you to check out this book, a great read. It's called The Last Hero, A Life of Henry Aaron. Actually, he started his career when he was very young, only 18 years old. He left home to join the Indianapolis Clowns in the Negro League. Tell everybody about the Indianapolis Clowns.
Well, the Clowns for him, Indianapolis, is a bit of a misnomer because they never played their games there. And it was funny because in a different time, Henry Aaron would have been the marquee draw, and this would have been the peak of his ambition. However, by the time he got there in 1952, the Negro Leagues were pretty much dead, and Henry Aaron was going to be the last generation of player that even went through the Negro Leagues. Now teams were beginning to sign African-American players directly to their farm systems. And so Aaron was essentially this rising comet in a land of ghosts. And he was there for exactly a month. And while he was there, he tore up the league naturally because of his ability. But at the same time, I think there was a bittersweetness to it all because there was a world that was ending, and he was at the last vestige of it.
He played in the Sally League, and for those people that are not familiar with that, at that time in baseball, you had multiple minor leagues down there, and it was the first time he had left home. He had left Mobile, Alabama. How traumatic was that for him?
Well, pretty traumatic, considering that over a six-month period, here's a guy who had never left the state of Alabama and then suddenly was on an airplane to Winston-Salem and then on an airplane to Eau Claire, Wisconsin. And then within a few months after that, found himself in the Sally League playing for Jacksonville. There's a lot of life hitting him very quickly. And I think that in its own way was good for him because it underscored once more that there was nothing back there for him, nothing. Even when he was very sad and when he wanted to quit the game, his family said, look, there's nothing back here for you. You've got a different path. And I think it's really, it was one of the things I wanted to work on very hard in the book was to ask these players about their despair. And virtually 9 times out of 10, these black players would talk about how their families, instead of saying, yeah, come on home, it's tough, told them to stick it out because you were going to do something that was going to have repercussions far beyond you.
Interesting you bring that up, because in talking to Hall of Famer Joe Morgan, he told me that when he started in the minor leagues, his first stop, of course, was with the Durham Bulls down in North Carolina. And he said that when he got out and went out to the outfield, he saw all the black people sitting in one section of the stadium.
Mm-hmm.
And being from California, he called his father and says, I'm not putting up with that. I'm coming home. And his dad said, no. What did he have to deal with being one of the few blacks in that Sally League?
Well, I think the first thing he had to deal with was maintaining his emotions and realizing that you had a job to do and that nobody was watching. You didn't have that protection that Jackie Robinson had where the organization was supporting him. It was him and Felix Mantilla and Horace Garner, and you had to go and concentrate on doing the job. And the better you did the job, the the less amount of time you would be in the Sally League. And I think it was very difficult for him simply because I think that, once again, you're asking a lot of a kid who really wasn't very well equipped to handle the things that were thrown at him, but his ability forced him to deal with situations that he normally probably wouldn't have had to.